are unwilling to compromise, and of course that puts them right outside the space where the Israelis are happy to negotiate, which they have been with the PLO. And of course today's security cooperation there is between the Palestinian Authority and Israel is a key weeping sore within the liberation movement. But you have someone like Haddad who is unwilling to compromise, is associated with Black September, and eventually of course what happens is that the Israelis assassinate him. Yeah. I mean, really vicious means of assassination. They sneak into his apartment, they change the toothpaste in his bathroom for a poison so that every day he brushes his teeth, poison seeps into his system. And they don't know what's wrong with him. Eventually Arafat sanctions him being sent to East Germany to a specialist hospital, and they can't even work out what's wrong with him. He dies in horrible pain. And this is typical of the Israelis, the kind of strategy they've used to assassinate people who are outside the scope of negotiation according to their strategies.
Yes, indeed. Well, we're just going to pause the discussion there for a moment to report about another Palestinian non-combatant, Neji Al-Alali, who was also assassinated, and also about Israel's use of double agents operating in Britain.
Political cartoonist Neji Al-Alali was born in 1937 in Al-Sajara village in Palestine, prior to the Zionist occupation. Ali was 10 when the Nakba drove his family out of their village, forcing them to flee to Lebanon, where they lived in the Ain al-Helwa refugee camp in Sidon. He developed his talent for sketching sarcastic interpretations of the political landscape at the time. Ghassan Kanafane met Ali in the camp in the 1950s and helped him get work with a few newspapers. This eventually led to Ali moving to Kuwait to work for the papers Al Siyasa and Al Khabas through the 1960s and 1970s. It was in Kuwait that Ali developed the character he is most famous for, Handala. The depiction of a 10-year-old barefoot and bedraggled Palestinian child with his back turned became iconic across the world. Ali asserted that the character represented the condition of Palestinian refugees waiting to return. Ali's works were not just observational pieces on the Palestinian condition, but also piercing critiques of the major political actors of the day. His attacks on Gulf leaders are believed to be behind his decision to leave Kuwait with his family and settle in London in 1985. Ali had also begun criticizing the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat through his work, particularly the influence of a female companion on the figurehead. Ali was believed to have received more than 100 death threats before his liquidation in London. On July the 22nd, 1987, Ali was shot outside the office of Al Khabas newspaper in Knightsbridge, London. He died around a month later. In the immediate aftermath of the killing, British police arrested Ismail Sowan, who was not only an employee of the PLO, but also an Israeli agent. The Israelis paid the rent for the very apartment that Sowan was arrested in by the British police. Sowan claimed that while he was not the killer, the team that carried out the assassination had used his flat as a base for operations. The British Prime Minister at the time, Margaret Thatcher, was so outraged at this information that she expelled the Israeli handler of Sowan and closed the Mossad base in Britain. The truth of Neji Al-Ali's assassination is still unknown, but British police reopened the investigation in 2017.
Omar, I wonder if you could tell us about Neji Al-Ali's character, Handala.
Yes, so Handala is a 10-year-old Palestinian refugee child. And in the classic pose, you know, that you see is barefoot and his back is facing the audience and hands clasped behind his back. And many believe that this is a kind of symbolism that denotes a rejection of outside or imposed solution to the Palestinian struggle. And Handala, of course, famously remains 10 years old, right, as Ali had wished for it to be, in part really, you know, symbolizing kind of the ongoing need for the total right of return of the Palestinian people to be implemented and something which has yet to be realized. And so in many cases, people see the perpetual youth of this character as kind of an artistic reflection, you know, of the ongoing need to kind of end this, colonially imposed atrocity and to finally allow the Palestinian people to return home.
David, I mean, Kuwait seems to have been a hub for pro-Palestinian thinkers at different points, doesn't it? I mean, why do you think that was?
Well, I mean, Kuwait was had a policy of allowing Palestinian refugees to come and on preferential terms compared to other immigrants from the region. And so there were very many Palestinians in Kuwait working there, I think a quarter of a million or so, perhaps more. And it was so it was a kind of refuge for Palestinian refugees until, of course, the moment where there was the conflict over Iraq in 1990, when Iraq went into Kuwait. It seems that the apparent invitation of the Americans. And the PLO's view was to support Iraq and Saddam Hussein. And thus the Kuwaiti government expelled 250,000 Palestinians. And that was the moment which that was over, and that game was over. And most of the Arab states, of course, were opposed to Saddam Hussein in 1990, and were effectively supporting the West in its military intervention. The Turkey Shoot, if you recall it was called, when they went in and killed thousands of people in the road to Baghdad. And so that was the formation of Kuwait. And of course, you see this process all the way through of the places that the Palestinians had to go to. They went to Jordan, they went to Lebanon, some of them went to Syria, or, of course, in Kuwait. And sometimes those places were closed down. Of course, famously, the Israelis forced the PLO out of Lebanon and sent them over to North Africa in the 1980s. So it's a process of where can these refugees go while they wait to come back to their homes, while they wait to expel the occupiers and to decolonize the occupation of Palestine. So that's the process, and that's why Kuwait was important then, and it became a terror incognito after that, because they couldn't stay.
Well, Omar, I wonder what they might say. I mean, what kind of criticisms did Ali's work level at Yasser Arafat?
So many different types of criticisms, but really the thing to understand about Arafat is, you know, he has kind of a split. On the one hand, you know, seen as a very nationalist figure, very dedicated to the revolution. But what Ali was doing with Arafat, and to a certain extent, as he did with many politicians, was really trying to kind of probe beneath the surface and kind of expose what he felt to be a sense of hypocrisy. So this idea that, you know, there's a total dedication to Palestine, and yet there's an increasing number of decisions that are made that seem to be sort of conceding to the occupier, or, you know, moving toward a negotiated settlements rather than continuing, you know, kind of the armed liberation struggle. And of course, you know, for Ali, this was reflected in certain instances of personal corruption. But ultimately, really, the larger critique is this movement, this seeming concession, you know, that the Palestinian liberation under Arafat was making, moving toward a negotiated settlement rather than continuing, you know, a truly anti-colonial liberation struggle. And of course, this would include Ali's critiques, jibes, including, you know, a cartoon sort of mocking him and mocking his local cultural minister, Rashida Mahran. But the political substance of it really is this movement toward concession rather than, you know, and making these decisions that really aren't in the interest of the people.
No, absolutely. I mean, David, I mean, what do you make of these double agents arrested by British police following that killing?
Well, this is a very, very interesting tale. I mean, let's start with the fact that these people were working for Mossad. Whatever else they were working for, they were working for Mossad. And as you saw in the film there, Margaret Thatcher expels their handler, closes down the Mossad station. Now, people don't know this, do they? They don't know that actually that the Mossad was engaged in operations against Britain on British soil, that it was a hostile foreign power. And of course, as we've said in this programme before, this is one of many examples where the British security state realises that there's a problem here and it intervenes. And it was Thatcher who shuts down, of all people, the Mossad station. Now, of course, Thatcher has form in relation to Israel. And of course, there was a moment when she was Prime Minister where Menachem Begin came to the UK and she refused to shake hands with him because he regarded him as a terrorist. Now, there's the sign that even Tories can understand and get the point of this kind of spying in the UK. And Margaret Thatcher was up for that engagement. But let's go back to the other question. These were people who were PLO operatives. Were they PLO employees in the civilian sense, or were they armed operatives? And what's unclear about this is not whether the PLO and the Mossad were involved, but exactly what was the apportionment of responsibility. So it's not impossible that the PLO directed these killings, but at the same time, the people who were involved in the killings were actually Mossad double agents. I mean, we don't know exactly what the relationship was, but we already see the kind of dirty dealing and the double dealing of the PLO evident in this case, and that has only become much more significant. Mm. So that today we have the PLO engaged through the Palestinian Authority in security cooperation, including arrests and tortures of ordinary Palestinians, including killing ordinary Palestinians. Yeah. And we see that happening as the resistance rises in the West Bank. Now, we have a split, of course, in the Palestinian Authority. There are members of the PLO and Al-Aqsa Brigade, Martyrs Brigades, who are joining with the Lion's Den or with Palestinian Islamic Jihad or with the Al-Qassam Brigades and joining the resistance, which is rising in the West Bank. And that's a split. And the more that split continues, the better. But we still see the Palestinian Authority collaborating directly with the Israelis. And that's, truly appalling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid that we are out of time today. So let me thank our guest, Omar Zaza, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next week, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing presently on the topic of prophethood, and we are basing our discussions on the various statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are presently focusing on the first sermon, whereby there are certain statements there that beautifully explain certain aspects of prophethood and messengerhood. And presently, we were discussing about the topic or the subtopic of the continuity of the mission of the prophets or the continuity of the prophetic mission. And in the continuity of the prophetic mission, we say there are certain elements that need to be present. At least one of them, one of these four elements have to be there so that the prophetic mission is continuous. We talked about, Nabiyun Mursal, the presence of a sent prophet, or Kitabun Munzal, or a book that is revealed, you see. So sometimes the prophet is not there, but the book is there, and the teachers of the book are there. أو حجة لازمة, or a binding proof. أو محجة قائمة, or a path which is usable, which is present, and which is there. So these are the four things that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentioned. At the moment, we are focusing on the idea of حجة لازمة. That means a binding proof.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, the third element which is necessarily has to be present if the other elements are absent is the presence of a firm proof, a binding proof, a proof that is convincing and not just an empty proof. Like sometimes you see, they will say that, no, if you don't understand that, then just open your heart and believe. What do you mean by that? If that's the case, any Tom, Dick and Harry can come and tell you that, you know, just open your heart and believe and just say anything. Like, I mean, it doesn't make sense that if something that doesn't enter the intellectual reasoning is not firm proof to be able to be for the intellect to accept, and you just say, no, you just ignore the intellect and just listen to your heart. What do you mean by that? You know, it doesn't make sense. And that is why if someone has such an ideology, then they would be easily, you know, swayed from one corner to another. And the wolves that want to tear apart humanity can easily come and, you know, misguide and tear you apart. You need firm proof to be able to speak against them. And we give the example of Nabi Isa alayhi salam and his teachings, whereby the book, unfortunately, the Injil, did not reach us. And we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that when Nabi Isa alayhi salam comes back, he's able to show us that original Injil, the real and true gospel that was there with him. What we have now is the narration of different gospels from various narrators, you know, the four famous ones, the other that are not so famous, but they are all there. And these are various narrations of the gospel, and they don't claim even that this is the revealed book of God, but they say that this is the teachings of Jesus that they collected and during their lifetimes. But yet amongst all of these teachings, there are certain clear and binding arguments that a person can accept, and those are the ones that retained the teachings of Nabi Isa alayhi salam. And that is why till today we can see that aspects of Christianity has been able to save humanity from corruption. Like, we do not deny the fact that there are present today, even with all of the interpolation that has happened in the Bible, still there are very good aspects of human learning and human teachings that are present, that can be adhered to, that can help humanity to come out of many problems.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, these clear arguments are normally there as a guide, as lamps of guidance in the absence of the book. Now, at a time, sometimes a book can be present also, but the book is inaccessible. How? For example, the Quran. I'm not saying it is inaccessible. No, it is accessible. It is there. But there are some aspects of the deeper meanings of the Quran that are not accessible for mankind. Those would be accessible if the imams were present and they would be helping us to shed light on the deeper understandings of the Quran. Don't get me wrong, the Quran is accessible in the sense that we can understand as a normal human being. If you pick up the book, the apparent verses of the Quran are understandable and they are binding necessarily. So we shouldn't say because the imams are not present, we can't understand the apparent verses of the Quran. No, no, no. What I mean is the internal and deeper meanings of the Quran are somehow inaccessible for normal men, normal people. And it is necessary that the imams be present to shed light on that. So it is as if to say that some aspects of the book is hidden. Even in this situation, we can say that we need hujjatun lazima, firm argument, to be able to access those aspects that are not accessible by our own thinking when we look at the book directly. And for that hujjatun lazima is the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, and the teachings of certain scholars who have deeply tried to compare the different verses and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam to show us what some aspects of the hidden meanings of the Quran could mean. And this is, you could say, is part of Hujjatul Lazima, that those arguments that are clear and that are binding and they can apply towards the people. Even though the book is present, certain aspects of the book that are hidden could be shown to us, could be brought to us through these clear binding proofs, and we can apply them in our lives and at least achieve those aspects of the prophetic mission that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam had in mind for us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
سيد فاز من ولا هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, 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 Hussein. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you. I cry for you in pain.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, esteemed listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we aim to address your inquiries, concerns, and questions regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Our experts provide answers rooted in the teachings of the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. Today we will delve into the topic of instilling the significance of religious events, such as Muharram, in children. So stay tuned for valuable insights and guidance on this matter. Well, today in our studio we have Professor Salman Nakavi to guide us more on the topic. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, Professor. So in the previous episode, we had been talking about what strategies could be involved to teach our children about the importance of religious events, and we explored on the topic of Muharram. Now, since we're talking about Muharram, towards the end of our discussion, we talked about the characters of Karbala, and there's a lot to learn from them. There's a lot to get inspired about them, and we should be taking care of age appropriate content when it deals with the children, because when we share age appropriate content, that's how they won't get bored. That's how they will feel like we're learning something from this particular majlis. Well, how can the stories of the characters of Karbala itself inspire and teach important values to children?
Yes, one of the unique things about Karbala is that you have a character for every age. There's a role model, there's an example for every age group. You can start with the people like Habib ibn Mazahir of a very old age, in the maybe 80s or even more than that, right down to the smallest age group, that is of the 6 months age of Ali Asghar. So for every age group, for ladies, for gents, for older people, for the youth, you have Ali Akbar, Hazrat Abbas, you have Qasim. For every age group, you have an example.
Right.
Bibi Zainab, Bibi Umm Kulsum, mothers, sisters, daughters, brothers, sons. For every age group, you have a character whom you can look upon to and learn from. So it's a beautiful combination of a whole a family group which is there, and they have set out together on a common mission. It's not that the ladies, the women folk, have come just as companions in the sense that they just had to be along with Imam Hussein. No, they were very well knew Imam Hussein had a purpose, had a mission, and they accompanied him to achieve that mission. So that is important, that we understand that our children and our families should realize that it's not that when we come out to commemorate Imam Hussein's sacrifice or the sacrifice of any Imam or the Holy Prophets, whomever we talk about, it's not that we are just, our duty is to remember them. It's not, that's only one part of it. Yes, it is important that we have we love the Ahlul Bayt.
Right.
We show our love for them. We have to have mawaddah for them. Mawaddah is, as the Quran says, Allah Almighty has asked the Holy Prophet to ask only for one thing from his ummah, from his people, and that is the mawadda of the Ahlul Bayt. He is asked to, he is asked by Allah Almighty not to ask anything as a wage for his hard labor for the ummah apart from the mawadda of the Ahlul Bayt. One thing is required from the from by the Holy Prophet, and that also according to the command of Allah Almighty, that I require only one thing from you, and that you have the mawadda of my family. And mawadda is not just loving the Ahlul Bayt. It is not just expressing that love by speaking for them and talking about them and expressing our feelings about them. That is just one part. More than that is to follow in their footsteps.
Right.
That is the highest level of mawadda.
Right.
And that comes to tawalli. That is following in their footsteps.
Right. Professor, we'll discuss more with you and dwell more into this topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. We are with Professor Sayyid Salman Nakavi, and we're discussing the stories of the characters of Karbala, how they could inspire our children. Yes, Professor.
So even we were saying that number one, for those who are of a higher mature age, they should understand, our children should understand the concept of Imamat itself. That is the pivotal concept.
Right.
That is the most important thing.
Central thing.
Central thing. Imamat is not just some spiritual thing. Yes, it is spirituality. It is imams are rooted, their whole existence in this world is based, rooted in spirituality.
Right.
They belong to a higher class of existence. There's no doubt about it. Just as the Holy Prophet is, the Quran says about the Holy Prophet, "Yes, ana rajulun mislukum. I'm like you, but there's one difference from with. I'm different. Apparently, I'm like you. Apparently, I have a body like you. I eat like you. I drink like you. I walk like you. I do everything like as you are human beings, but there's one difference. I'm of a level where I can communicate with Allah Almighty directly.
All right.
You, Hailiya, I'm of a capacity that I can communicate with Allah Almighty. You can't do that.
Right.
So this has to be understood, both aspects of Imamat. The spiritual concept, the aspect of Imamat has to be understood by our children. And the apparent implications which are there in society.
So you're trying to say that when we introduce the concept of Imamat to our children, we should be introducing it like it's not some kind of some fantasy story. They were also human beings, but they exhibited all those spiritual qualities which make them reach the highest spiritual proximities.
They're supposed to be followed. Of course, we can't become achieve that level.
Right.
But we need to lead, take their lead and follow their examples. So this is very important. Our children, if we just emphasize the ritualistic aspect of this commemoration and this, whether it's Muharram or even days of joy like Ghadir,
right,
or
the birthdays of imams.
Imams, or the day like Mubahila,
right,
or Ghadir, or the
other days, Eids.
The birth anniversaries of the imams. It's not whether we're talking about our commitment to them. We're talking about our relationship with them. How do we connect with them? What role do they play in our daily lives? Our children should be from day one. It should be ingrained in their minds that they need, on one hand, to take the Holy Quran in their hands and they need to cling on to the Ahlul Bayt.
Right.
This has to be imbibed from day one in the minds of our children, because that is the problem which we are facing today.
Right.
The Holy Prophet emphasized, stressed, beseeched his the thing. He said, I'm leaving you with two very precious things, the Holy Quran and the Ahlul Bayt.
Right.
You need to cling on to them. You need to clutch to them. So this has to be instilled in our children from day one.
Right.
And yes, these rituals are there just for that sake, that we are able to connect with our imams.
Right.
We need to connect. These rituals are there. These commemorations are there, so that we can connect with our, with the imams, especially
right.
the imam of the age.
Right.
And we need to show that, express our love for them, express our commitment to them, and show them that we are ready to go along the path they did.
Right.
It's not that we have one aspect of our lives which is secular and the other aspect which is religious.
Right. Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Sayyid Salman Akavi, and we're discussing how the stories or the characters of Karbala could inspire our children. So are there any particular characters in the event of Karbala itself that could inspire our children, especially those in the teenage?
Yes, you have so much, so many examples. I mean, I would wonder what we would think about Ali Asghar alayhi salam, that he was of a so tender age, 6 months of age, and he supposedly, we think that he couldn't understand what's happening, but that is not the case. Even when some of our scholars speak about him, and the way he threw himself out of the cradle, that as if he wanted to go into the field, battlefield.
Right.
It was an expression of his readiness and his commitment.
So that, and then the smile after that.
Exactly.
Taking that,
and even some
obedience.
Exactly. Sometimes it is also related that he himself stood up on the hands of Imam Hussein to become the target of the arrow of the tyrant and the cursed person, Harmala. So, and for, I mean, starting from that very tender age, we find then the example of Hazrat Qasim, who is beseeching his uncle to allow him to practice and to carry out what his father had asked him to do, and had ordered him to do, and had written even in his will that you one day shall come and you will be faced with such a situation and you shouldn't remain behind.
Right.
So, I mean, this is a situation where we can
the children of Lady Zainab, salamu alayha,
exactly,
who are of very tender age.
So many children, youth are there who are, all of them are of a very tender age, and despite their tender age, they are ready to go out and to fight. And this also shows that all were the Ahlul Bayt. Yes, we talk about Islam as a religion of peace. No, it's yes, it is a religion of peace, but it is also a religion of war.
Right.
I mean, it's not that sometimes we say that, look,
A day and a night that complete the 24 hours. There's a bright side and always...
Exactly. No, I mean, there's when we talk about war, when we talk about... Yes, we say we did not spread Islam through the sword.
Right.
One of the very beautiful things, important things that we have to make our children understand. Sometimes they are faced with this issue, with this challenge. Muslims, they were always fighting. They was also always, using the sword. they were...
And there's also that Islamophobic content,
yes,
shared on this
occupying
media.
Lands, they were conquering lands, they were spreading Islam with the help of the sword. But that's not the case. But still, we should realize that even war against the enemies of Allah is something which is based on principles and based on ethics. We can talk about that later.
Right. So we have to make one thing very clear to our children, that whenever there's a warlike situation, especially to stand for Allah, we have the characters of Karbala, the children of Karbala show us the readiness, the obedience, and the commitment to Imam. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIP English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Economic divide.
When it comes to the Israeli protests, you have to hand it to them. They've been protesting for 7 months now. Well, let's make some things clear right from the get-go. Even though they call it protest, well, we think the Israeli regime is rupturing from within. We don't recognize it having a judiciary, since we don't recognize it as being a legitimate entity, or we look at it as an apartheid regime or an occupier. In that light, what is the impact of these protests? I'm Kavit Tafwi. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the headlines coming up. Israeli protests, the impact on the economy is our focus. The central bank is worried. A currency devaluation is also taking place. So the protests are having an impact on the economy. Next, Netanyahu's economic policies. It's contributed to a high cost of living. Also, the protests have resulted in inflation, especially when it comes to Israel's shekel. And then investor confidence has been sapped. That's right. And then comes the most important of all, Israel's future. What's in store for it? There's a period of instability that's going through right now, not only from within but from the outside. You have a cabinet that's too extreme, and yet you have these so-called judicial reforms. Some say that leads to corruption, since there are no checks and balances.
Israel is facing a domestic crisis. The turmoil is related to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence on a package of judicial changes that many fear would threaten the regime's so-called democratic system. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had said that the changes will stop the courts from overreaching their powers, but critics say that they will help him as he faces an ongoing trial for corruption. Crisis has not been limited to the political sphere.
We're in a demonstration, lawyers' demonstrations, against what they call the reform, which is not a reform. It's a small step to dictatorship. They're going to ruin the intent. They try to ruin our judicial system.
Combined with other factors, would cause the Israeli per capita GDP to decrease by almost 1.5% annually over the next few years. Analysts believe if the crisis is not resolved peacefully and the turmoil lingers on, economic confidence would decline and growth would contract to just 1% in 2023.
Time to check out some social media posts and what's been posted online on this topic. First up, protests in Tel Aviv. Israel has moved to an intense stage of protest after Netanyahu's sacking of the Minister of Military Affairs. That was very important. Then we move on to a website, huge uncertainty for investors and the economy as Israel pushes for controversial reforms. Went on to say Israel's shekel is down more than 6% in February and at its lowest against the dollar in 3 years. The former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak called the plans an assassination of the Declaration of Independence, which will turn Israel into a dictatorship. Our next post was a website also. Israeli firebrands are turning on central banker after targeting judges. Governor Yaron faces populist anger from rightist ministers. Investors are watching to see if he is reappointed by Netanyahu. And finally, we went to YouTube and took a look at this entry, a bill which would allow Israel to pass any law it likes, unimpeded by its court oversight, passed, and it, for it to have passed its first parliamentary vote. Once it has free rein to pass the laws, the new cabinet and the agreement that brought it to power says it plans to extend Israeli settlements. Let's take a look at the video.
Hundreds of thousands took to the streets in protest Tuesday after a bill which would allow the to pass any law it likes, unimpeded by Supreme Court oversight, passed its first parliamentary vote.
All right, those were some of the posts that we picked. Hope you liked it. Let me introduce our guests for this program. First up, Bruce Katz, co-president at the Palestinian and Jewish Unity, joins us. Bruce Katz, welcome to Economic Divide. All right, what's going on with these protests, Bruce Katz? I mean, obviously it's having an economic impact. I'd like to quote from you that Israel's central bank governor, who said there's a very broad consensus among economists, which is very unusual, the concerns about the potential effects of the economy of these protests. How concerned should Israel be when it comes to these protests?
Well, I think they should be extremely concerned, especially if you consider what is happening to the value of the shekel against the euro and the U.S. dollar. In February alone, the shekel had lost 6% of its value, and that's been sliding since. So essentially what that causes is basically aggravates in inflation. What it means in effect is the higher cost of consumer goods, people who end up having to pay increased mortgage payments. We're seeing some of that, as a matter of fact, in Canada without the political crisis. But it means also higher interest rates for borrowing, and it also scares investors away. I mean, investors are not going to invest in a country which is in political turmoil, and that political turmoil is there to stay.
All right, Bruce Katz there. Need to remind you, the viewer, that in terms of legitimacy of Israel as an entity is how we see it, not as a country, as our guest there indicated. Write to us if you think we're right or wrong on that. Our next guest is Martin Saif. He's a former managing editor at United Press International, UPI, if you recall. Martin Saif, welcome to Economic Divide. All right. The Prime Minister Netanyahu, he was a former finance minister, which I'm sure you're well aware. And he realizes the impact that these protests is having on the economy. He even has created a committee in order to tackle the high cost of living that's happening, which is compounded by these protests. What do you make of the statements that he has made, blaming the economic challenges on hidden monopolies on the one hand, and of course what he wants to do or intends to do to make things better?
Mr. Netanyahu is politically extremely brilliant in handling domestic politics. He is also very good at setting up coalitions and creating political coalitions, and he has done it again here. But the people he has done it with this time are far more implacably determined to push through policies that really do alienate and even enrage the middle classes and the professional classes. So the contradictions in Mr. Netanyahu's policy are now being exposed.
It's time now for our InfoNews section. We first begin with a developing story, and it has to do with de-dollarization moves. India has been at the forefront of ditching the dollar in bilateral trade with two countries, first the UAE, then Indonesia. It joins the group of 60 countries who have ditched the dollar for their bilateral trade, weakening the dollar's clout. Now to economic news. First up, we take a look at a tour of many that the Iranian president has taken, this one to Africa, in which he visited Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. Iran's president has said that Iran is ready to transfer its technology to these countries. Our analysis of this is that if the African continent has the minerals and the resources, and Iran can help with its energy needs, then where does the West fit in this equation? Iran is after a win-win situation.
There are many fields in which Iran has gained a foothold in, such as high-tech industries and pharmaceuticals. Considering the low cost of production in our country, there's a lot we can offer.
Next up, taking a look at some damage costs. This comes in the country of France, where they're taking a look at how much damage the protests have incurred on the country recently. And the economic costs are pretty high. So far, $721 million is the insurance bill. Now, we took a look at this in a different way. Our analysis is, be careful what you wish for, President Macron. Didn't you receive Iran's enemy, Masih Ali-Nejad, at the Elysee Palace and supported someone who incited violence in the Islamic Republic? That's how we looked at this situation. All right, next up to the UK, the government has made a final offer. That's it. No ifs, ands, or buts. The public sector workers' pay rise, that has been enacted, even though there was a doctor strike, but the government says that it will offer doctors and teachers a 6% pay rise. No amount of protest, the government said, will change its mind, and it's not open to negotiations. All right, now we ask, how does a 6% pay rise help UK families when, one, the core CPIH annual inflation rate was 6.5% in May of 2023, and two, food prices have risen around 18 to 19%.
Today's offer is final. There will be no more talks on pay. We will not negotiate again on this year's settlements, and no amount of strikes will change our decision.
All right, that's what the UK government has to deal with in terms of its people who are very angry about the 6% pay rise. Those were the topics we picked for our Info News section.
Financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
That section of the program. The Israeli protests have entered its 7 month in a row. Israelis are sending out a plea for help. SOS, we're going to take a look at some of the economic impacts, and the categories is what you're going to take a look at now. First, the warning that has been issued. This warning has come from central bankers and also from top economists. Moving on, we take a look at the losses that have been incurred as a result of these protests. A big hit for the Israeli economy. The shekel, its unit of money, has been impacted, devaluation. Stock market obviously has taken a hit because of these protests. And of course, the GDP therefore has decreased. And all of this amounts to what's called a recession, which has been predicted. Of course, all of this is not good news for the economy of Israel as a whole. All right, let's take a look first at the first category, which I mentioned over there, and that was the warning that has been issued. In terms of the warning, we're taking a look at what some of the top economists have said, which includes former central bankers. This so-called judicial overhaul, which we don't believe in, will actually cripple the economy. That's what they have said, and that's strong wording. And the reason why they say that will occur is because we can checks and balances. It means that there's not going to be an oversight when you have their so-called judiciary not have the control that they used to have. Moving on to the next category, which is the losses that have been incurred. That's something that is very important. In terms of the losses, which is about to come up, here we're going to take a look at the amount of money that Israel's economy has suffered as a result of the protests. Don't forget, 7 months in a row. Over 150 billion shekels. That translates to about $41 billion. Many are not aware of that. It's not reflected in the news that much. And the households, as a result, have lost $13,500. The protests lasted this long. Okay? Next up, let's take a look at this had on Israel's unit of money. We're about to see this has resulted in it being devalued. That's one of the consequences. Also, in terms of the value, it has been weakened. It was trading at 3.637 against the dollar, which is not that great. But what's more important, especially in the long run, is the inflationary threat that the weakened shekel poses. And that will add to the misery of people who are living in the occupied land there. Next up, the stock market, one of the biggest gauges that comes in terms of Israel's economy. The impact that the stock market is feeling right now is not good. And that has repercussions in many different ways. 1% so far in terms of the average median that the stock market has fallen. But take a look at this decoupling that has occurred from international markets, like the ones in the States, like the NASDAQ, for example. And in terms of the Israel economy, you're taking a look at a 20% decrease of the stock market that will ultimately result in a negative factor for the Israeli economy. Obviously, that's not good news for the companies who always look for investments in their stocks. Moving on to the next item, the GDP. We figured this is something, obviously, that needs to be taken a closer look at, because if Israel's economy is not increasing in its GDP, obviously it's not doing well. But how much of an effect? Now, the catastrophic effects based on the projections that have been made is going to be felt within 2 years, not at this point. But right now, there's been a negative 1.5% decrease that is happening, and it's on track. That's going to happen for the year that we're in. So the GDP, obviously, having a negative effect because of the protests. And our final look is at what is an obvious consequence, something that can't be ignored, and is going to have an impact in the form of a recession. Now, who has said that? Well, we went and looked at Zvi Eckstein, former Israeli Central Bank deputy governor. He said Israel's economy will see a recession next year. So it's on track. This year, obviously, as we just mentioned, the GDP taking a hit. Now, we want to take a look at the next item over here. This is of great significance, and I'll tell you why. Take a look at what this is about to say. Israel is rupturing from within. Pretty strongly worded statement, isn't it? But that's what people are saying. Palestinians are seeing that. Israel's allies are seeing that. That's what these protests have done. Take a look at this. Israel is rupturing from within. Never mind the political instability, especially when it comes from resistance groups and Palestinians. All right, let's find out what we're going to have coming up here, because there's a certain item that has not been mentioned. And that particular item is something that Mahdi is going to be telling us, who joins us right now, to tell us what that may be. Mahdi, what do you have for us?
Hi, Kaveh. There is one sector in Israel's economy that accounts for a major portion of its economic contribution, and that is the tech sector. From investment to employment, I'll tell you all about in the Quick Tech section coming up later.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Mahdi. All right, let me introduce our guest for this edition, reintroduce our guest for our in-depth section. We have Bruce Katz rejoining us. He's the co-president of the Palestinian and Jewish Unity, who rejoins us. Bruce Katz, welcome back to Economic Divide. We've looked at these protests now for 7 months. They have grown in intensity. Obviously, the protesters themselves have also been dealt a heavy hand by the regime forces. When you take a look at this environment, doesn't it just sap away the investments, even aspirations or any investment motivations, whether from within or outside of Israel, since the future of Israel, so to speak, is now at stake? and the investment environment is not there as we speak.
Well, let me first of all address the question of Israeli democracy. That's democracy for Jews only. It doesn't include non-Jews. That should be clear for everyone, and that goes back to the passing of the nation state law.